Killer Keller podcast. Killer Keller official.com.
Killer Keller podcast live show. Step into the live and dangerous world of music and street culture's number one magazine platform, the Killer Keller Podcast Live Show. Special guests alongside performances, news, reviews, profile pieces to a live studio audience. Your monthly live stream is here. Hit Facebook page Killer Keller Official.
Instagram UK Frontline.
101.4 FM, 24 hours a day, all genres.
NextFM.co.uk.
THTC, the UK's leading ethical streetwear label. Organically grown and ethically built garments from hemp, organic cotton and other sustainable materials. 2019 is their 20th anniversary year. Join me with THTC as a Killer Keller podcast sponsor celebrating music, social activism, hemp and street culture. THTC, eco-fashion redefined since 1999.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller podcast.
West side.
West considered best, but that's debatable. This is the Killer Keller podcast, live and direct. Central London, essential as you need to be, all right? Big shout out to Graffiti Kings. And right. Getting into this thing on a beautiful morning. I have a friend of mine that I have known long enough. He pretty much was a part of my introduction to the music industry, and I would have been a fan for decades before. Pretty much, he was a pioneer in graffiti realism, styles for days, producer, artist in his own right, the mighty. Part two inside
mighty.
The house. Come on.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Mr. Keller.
How are
Long
you,
time.
Bro?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I just kind of come from one point in London. It was sunny. Got on a tube, popped out the other side, straight out of the womb. And just pissing it down. Can I swear?
Oh, you can do what you want, mate. The occasional
language may alternate.
Yeah. So I put a sentence on. No parents in the room. I was watching the rain come down, and I had to say, I was like, dude, I hope you ain't walking right now. It was literally like light and day. It was like,
yeah. Poof. No, it was good. It was really coming down the windows, but I was in safe space. I was all right. I'm thinking, well, as long as that stops before I get off, if there's no overhanging rooftop on the Kensal Rise station, because I couldn't remember if there's a roof or not.
Do you see any pieces around there?
Quite a lot of track sides, yeah.
Have you noticed that? I've seen a lot of colour going on around them.
Quite a few colour ones, yeah. A few big things as well. Can't remember the names as much. I think it's more of a newer generation.
Yeah, it certainly is, yeah.
Yeah, people of my age, we kind of phase out of it a little bit. We don't know who people are anymore.
Well, I think it's a case of being there and watching. But, like, it often, like you say, we discover things when being entrenched in a scene and a thing, isn't it? Like, if you step out of it for a second, and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, like, oh, what's all this, you know?
Well, I think I've slowly kind of pulled away from any scene. I've kind of gone into my own kind of solitary space with things, really. Even a lot of artwork I do, or painting-wise, I don't really try to promote it in any kind of scene. In some ways, I've kind of backed right out of self-promotion because I just don't have too much interest in the kind of social media internet thing and just the way it's shaping our kind of culture in general, just all culture. It seems to be taking over, and I don't like the fact all my business is just completely at whim to corporate control space. It's not like
as in like space, social platforms and things like that.
Yeah, the space I walk in is the space I walk in. The people I meet down the street, like yourself or whoever, that's my universe. That's kind of mine. It's mine to own, not for kind of data miners to own and ship around and make profits on it. So I just find it a bit like, well, we know it's corporate control space. We know everything we eat, everywhere we go out, every party you may go to, or everything you paint or do, or whatever you listen to when you post your little YouTube clips and whatever. It's kind of, we're kind of stuck in this corporate control space. So I'm a little bit wary of it, just from a personal point of view.
There's an anarchic approach to graffiti and also street culture as a whole. How much of it do you feel like nowadays we all, it almost feels like we fall in line. I know I do, by no other choice, because not only is it the way that you're forced to go, but it's the way the audience consumes shit now. Like, do you feel like we fall in line a lot?
I think a lot of it falls in line. And those of us who don't want to necessarily toe that line end up kind of, either having to remove ourselves or we find ourselves kind of almost being removed.
Yeah.
So like I say, like in general, I just feel like everything is... I think I was saying to you on the phone the other day that you can go to Shoreditch and the look of the place, if there isn't a wall painted with a with an artwork on, whatever, there's tags, faux-ups, everything is plastered. It looks like Ladbroke Grove back in the day.
Yeah.
But it's not that. It's almost like an advertising colony for, oh my God. For corporate companies to kind of, oh, let's pay,
inspect.
I don't know, let's pay 50K for a company's wall.
Yeah.
But then that company gets them and then they pay the artist something like 2K or something. Yeah. And you just got this, it's quite disturbing,
you think
I think.
It's quite back scratchy.
It's not what it was about. I mean, I come from a grassroots level of that part of culture in terms of... I mean, I don't even like to use the G word, with, followed by the R-A-T-T or, you know, F and all that in street. I'm not really interested.
I mean, you cited
interested.
On the phone, you cited...
Spray practice.
Yeah.
Because I just think the medium is bigger than all of it. It's transcended any boundaries you can try and pigeonhole things into.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, people think street art... to some degree is part of an art world. It's not even in art world. They're not sitting next to Anish Kapoor in the White Cube or wherever, you know. It's not kind of on that level. It's a million miles away from it. You kind of... It's almost like its own little ghetto. Oh, we'll call that urban art, and then the gatekeepers will say who gets in and who doesn't.
Because at the end of the day, it's the gatekeeper model, isn't it?
That's it.
And it's who garners the most money.
Exactly.
That's street art.
I mean, I've got to make money, but I try and keep it a safe distance from it all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I try and do a lot more writing than I did because I think a lot of the time we fought with the can or with the paint rather than actually looking at what it is we're doing or trying to put some context out there. So if we can all complain, oh, they don't understand it, oh, these people outsiders don't really know what it's really about, they don't know what's real. End of the day, if we don't write things down in some kind of theoretical context, then... we're not taking control of it.
Whoa, that's deep. You know? Yeah, you're fucking right. Listen, for those of you that don't know enough about this man here, there's a visual element to what Part 2 does and there's an audio set, and it's not... They're not in different order state. It's the same. It's like... You were very much on the crest of... stylistically in your own lane, but at the same time, there was this fledgling... broken beat, trip-hop, new wave of music coming out in the early noughties that, I don't know, I just felt like your sound, along with, you know, the Flesh crew, originally Flesh Roll, Reducer Leem and Toasty Taylor, big up the boys. Oh, big up Dave Budgeon as well, who reconnected us fucking up.
Yeah, yes, Dave.
He was like fucking Cilla Black in this piece.
Bass guitar. Master.
yeah, totally. But, you know, these connectors and dude, like, your sound, it almost was like a visual equivocal of, like, graph.
Well, for me, I see it as the same thing.
Yeah.
Sound, visual, sonics, you know, I almost look at it, I'm not a synesthesia. I don't have synesthesia as a condition, but I see it all in that context, like, you know, a painting may have a kind of sound to it or waveform to it, and sound can create kind of images or whatever. And some people, you know, can look at a painting who have the actual condition and they can hear it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's different types of that condition, synesthesia. But I see synesthesia as almost like a kind of healthy way of looking at things rather than everything being pigeonholed into different categories and boxes.
Yeah.
I see everything as like everything is everything, and it's kind of what you make of it. Because for me, I may do things with permission, not permission from an art point of view. I may do illegal things, I may do legal things, I may do stuff that's more art-based stuff, maybe stuff that's more type-based. I don't really want to define myself in one particular box. So that's why it's easier for me to just define a culture of spray practice, because that don't make no difference to me whether you're bombing tracksides, painting trains, doing gallery shows, painting commissions, or doing graphic design, or just interior design, spraying furniture. Everyone's using that medium for something. And back in the day as well, we didn't have all these Beltons and Montanas. We had car paint and the occasional buntlack when you felt lucky.
I have this conversation with people all the time, right? Particularly on boards. Like, sometimes I see people pipe up on a board saying about an old school thing and how... you know, because I'm like, yo, do you have any idea, like, how hard it would be, you know, like a Nima and the pieces that he used to do, like, on trains?
Nima, Brighton.
Yeah, TPG. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the levels in which he was creating and, like you say, fucking with letters, like, with the quality of products.
That's it.
It's unfathomable.
I mean, some people just want to put a name up.
Yeah.
So it's basically about stamping the ID.
Yeah.
So tag is an ID and identity, which is more or less what the whole thing was about at a grassroots level, finding your own identity for using a medium that was never designed to make artwork with. It was designed for touching up cars and whatnot, you know. So in the 80s, that was kind of what we were doing, making do with what we had. It was very DIY. There wasn't a career on the table like these days.
Yeah.
What were we doing it for? That's the thing. We just did it.
Yeah.
It was a necessity.
Did
it.
Love that. And you were, listening, this is for documentation, you were one of the original. The buck stops fucking here in terms of photorealism on wall. Like, you were pioneering that shit so early doors.
Yeah.
Like, and then it nowadays, like you say, the technology on graph and paint and things, and how people consume it.
Yeah.
It becomes an abundance. And
it's just like anyone back in the day learning to use an airbrush. You can buy an airbrush. Yeah. Figure a few things out, get a bit of advice, and you're off. And there you are.
Part two is the one.
Here's something.
Right. Part two was the one. All right.
Well, I kind of regret it all now when I look at the global kind of saturation of that kind of stuff. I kind of wish it hadn't happened. But for me, you know, I mean, there was Pops 100 doing the odd bit of it was portraits really then. System did a few. There was Freedom in New York, tried a few. You know, it wasn't quite on that level yet. But then I just kind of got into it around the same time, because me and Pops both saw a Marilyn Monroe in Sheffield under Kelvin Flats, which is like a brutalist estate, which is now knocked down a long time ago. I think Anne Whittacombe knocked it down or something.
Really?
Now the people who used to live there just watched as they demonised and criminalised this whole estate.
What?
And they were like, hang on, this is our home. We all know each other. We walk along the balconies every day.
That,
yeah, yeah. And it was kind of like, I think there was a thing I found, an essay by somebody, and he's talking about how he stood there with the crowd watching them knock the one of the walkways down. And he's describing it as, wow. He couldn't help but think, but how are we going to get to the other block now? Because he was so... He
just in shock.
Still felt like he still belonged there.
Yeah.
And when it was knocked down, it was Anne Whittingham in the operating the thing, slamming the ball on it. And I remember he said, everybody's cheering. Like, hey, like it's a big event. And he's like, hang on, they're just knocking down our home.
Wow.
But going back to subjects, because I strayed...
There's everything to do with this podcast, bro.
There was a Marilyn Monroe. It was only the guy only did it once. I think it was a writer called Mercury. He used to write Redism, part of Sheffield, TDK, ACT, and them guys. I think we were influenced by that. But I think after a while, by about 1989, it was doing a Roy Ayres. I did a Roy Ayres just for a nightclub backdrop for a funk jazz funk night. And I did a Roy Ayres, and he said Joy. That's when I really kind of found it. I found the tones using really rubbish car paint, because it was kind of quite watered down, so I could blend the tones. And for me, at the time, I think by 88, it seemed to feel like in the mid-80s, we had a scene here, and it had its own style developed through Chrome Angels, Non-Stop, All Star Kings, this kind of more technical, refined... kind of style that was a bit more kind of futuristic, you know. Mm-hmm. Look at them old Goldie pieces like Future World Machines, all that. You know, it had something there. But I think by 88, it started to regress back to this New York style.
Yeah.
And it started to feel a bit like, as Acid House came out, a lot of people stopped writing.
Mm.
The country had house raids all over the country, and a lot of people gave up. And the only thing we were left doing it were the people like myself were or whatever. And there was a lot of select people in different cities across the UK who were just like, hang on, I'm just getting good at this.
Is this where... You know? exactly, yeah.
So the photorealism, really, it was just a thing like I kind of felt like I'd done all the letter thing and I'd done every kind of angle on it, and I just wanted to go, okay, well, I'm not really bothered about a scene anymore because there isn't one.
Mm.
So as there's no scene and everyone's out raving, pilled up, let me... I wanted to see what else you can do with this paint. Can you use it like a paintbrush? Can you use it to such... that, you know, a level.
And it's, and nowadays it's so seen as being like the not the norm, because it's not an easy thing to do. But with everything that street art encompasses, it's almost seen as, it's almost, dare I say it, slightly dirty that you don't put your tag or a, I don't know, a validity. It has to almost like, it's almost like street art just allows anyone to do that anyway without any sort of validity. That's it.
That's it.
I got
it. No, you got it. I think the thing is, well, you got all access to all this paint. People, most of them got paint sponsorship. You got all these different caps and nozzles. Whereas back then, we had to make the caps ourselves. I remember making the first stencil tips just with a Stanley knife by blading off a lid.
What?
So you got the middle, blading off the top so you can put your finger in so it slots back on the can. You know, the middle of the lid?
Yeah.
So you cut out all the outer, so you got the middle, goes on, then you just pierce a hole in the front. And we were doing, they sell them now.
Fuck.
It's just a homemade nozzle from the 80s.
That's mad.
Yeah.
That's mad.
And everything, yeah, I remember Juice in Birmingham was doing mixing nozzles, just using the WD-40 tubes. When you turn one upside down, the paint from the bottom can goes up into the top.
That's
can.
Right.
No, we were mixing pinks out, Duplicolor.
Yeah, Miriam explained.
Red and white Duplicolor
yeah.
and making our own pinks. And if you do it for a while, you can use it and you got one pink, then you can take the same kind of mix a bit more in and keep changing the shape.
Different shapes. Is it less of a
like very, very subtle varying degrees?
Is there any worth in it doing in that happening that way now? Or is it really like all the creativity?
You can buy that. You can buy mixing nozzles now. But then again, you know, all these brands have got a million shades of everything anyway, so you probably don't need it.
Yeah.
But it's a bit like music, you know, everyone's using the same software, everyone's on Logic, so all the music starts to sound the same. It's the same with walls, you're just walking around wherever, Shoreditch, London, wherever you go, in Birmingham.
It starts seeming linear and
the same. It just looks like, I'm just looking at surfaces just full of coloured acrylic.
Yeah.
And but back in the day, I liked the fact you could have like car paint, but then you'd have a bit of bunt lac, which is a bit more matte. And then you'd have an outline with Hammerite Smooth Light or something.
Bro, I was thinking
so all
this.
The paint had different textures from satin to gloss to matte. And different kind of strengths.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I kind of liked
that
more.
Yeah, me too. I swear to God, I went down Brick Lane the other day and I thought that very same thing. I was like, I almost felt like...
You could peel it all off, couldn't you, and make yourself a plastic chair or something. You melt it all down. I don't know.
I just felt like it was so intense. And I don't think the intensity of like what the location has changed. Mm. It's always been like that.
Mm.
But the paint... you can hear when someone's used Ableton.
Mm.
You can hear when someone's used
exactly.
Logic. And it's the same thing with the aesthetic.
So everything is like beyond the aesthetics of what a particular genre is, say, like you say, broken beat or drum and bass or dubstep or whatever. End of the day, it all sounds like sort of the software.
Yeah.
The software kind of rules.
How do we fix this part two?
You've got to joyride that software or start pulling out all the analog machines again, which is a pain in the backside, really, because then you've got to start doing outputs on a desk, and it's just so easy to jump on Logic and just keep everything in the internal plugins and just
quick and easy.
And I can mix it done. I don't even need to go outside this machine, you know.
Yeah.
But you kind of got to get all the old analog stuff out and start kind of like, does the old Akai 3000 still work?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I get that old SP12 to work?
Because
how
that,
did I use it?
Did I use it?
Yeah, because it's like. All these kind of modes and switches.
Yeah. Lights and bleeps and shit.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be maybe novel, actually, in a negative sense, I don't know, but wouldn't it be amazing if, like, an ATG crew came out again, but this time that, you know, quote, naive style that people kind of put into the street art brackets at times, you know, I'm just saying, you know, little clause there because I fucking love it. But, you know, they go one step beyond and actually go back to fucking roots and literally do that with the nozzles. Everything is like a code of practice.
Mm.
Everything is for the end result being so, like personable, yet dangerous and hardcore. You know?
It's even more crazy is if people can do that, that's worth a lot of respect because you try and find that car paint now.
it's actually role reversal, isn't it?
You might find some and you might find out of five cans, three of them, the pressure's gone or something.
Yeah, yeah,
but, if you can find any of that stuff. But it's trying to get it back to that kind of analog. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of doing, you know, I do my own little art experiments that have nothing to do with painting in public space. Obviously, I've always worked in public space, but not so much lately. some of the experiments I'm doing, I'm kind of doing these things where I'm just making paintings out of rolling cans.
Explain that.
You put an elastic band around the can,
yeah.
So it's going off, and right. Just roll it so you get a straight line, and you just get completely impossible gestures.
Oh, that's
that
crazy.
You can't get with a hand.
Which you can't repeat ever, because it's done there.
Yeah, and you got the motion.
Yeah, of course. So you're going...
The trajectory. Yeah.
Can you do it hanging? You know, because some people, you get the buckets with the paint and they spin around and on
rope. You've got to do it like Jackson Pollock.
That's crazy.
So everything's got to be a flat environment. Yeah. So really, playing around. But that, for me, is much as people may think it's arty, whatever, I don't really care what anybody thinks, really. No. For me, it's more primal.
Yeah,
just going back to you're not even writing your name anymore. You're just seeing what things do
and
by
I'm not
nature.
What you think I am? I'm going to do this. You know,
just trying to get it back to some kind of almost like a rewilding kind of project, back to nature or something.
Yeah. You have to.
We're so unworlded now. You know.
Yeah, that's right. And you have to go back into a primal reaction to things that are the way. I know, go against the grain of what's going on now. You've got to... And I don't know how small a margin that is.
Yeah, because when you've got everything available in an instant, online and whatever, and you've got millions of people all over the world doing all these things, and you don't even know who's doing what where anymore. There was a point where everybody knew each other in a certain scene, or even in UK in the 80s, I could talk amongst other UK writers and we'd know who's doing what in Paris, who's doing what in Amsterdam or Berlin.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we kind of knew those things because it was like, it was a grassroots scene more. But now you just don't know what's going on. It's just, you know, it's not even ours anymore. It doesn't even belong to us. So at the end of the day, the only way to claim it back is to just abandon all their kind of terms, whatever they want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, people might think, oh, graffiti is something, that's what we're about. We're graph. But for me, I'm not interested in that word. Even if whether I'm doing artwork or art shows, or even if I was doing trains or something, I'd probably rather be called a terrorist or something than a graffiti. Because, you can imagine, innit? When you get them TV shows and you got someone like... You can hear Philip Schofield's voice. I can hear it now. It's clear, saying, "Oh, we've got a graffiti artist in the studio today." And how trivially you just feel a bit almost embarrassed to be called it. It's almost like you're deflated from the get-go.
And it's not like what we're suggesting here is you or I or anyone else to single themselves out as being particularly, you know, extraordinary compared to the rest of the world. But I feel what you're saying. With beatboxing, and I use it as a relative, I only know this, my friends, for I do know, is that when it comes to beatboxing, right, there's a lot more people that do that as well.
Yeah.
And it dilutes it. It almost becomes a bit where turntablism went in the mid-noughties.
Yeah.
A bit chin-strokey, a little bit kind of geeked out, should I say. You fall in line to that shit. And you fall in line to it, and what happens is everyone gets times with the same brush and it becomes you become the geek as
and we're not the same brush
and we're not the same brush
we're not the same brush at all. Everyone's like a different instrument in a kind of whole economy of whoever we are. We're we're like noise. We're just different noises.
We're
all meant to be making different noises, but half the time everyone's making the same noise. So you're not really playing your part. It's like I was into all that kind of jazz stuff, like Sun Ra Orchestra and everything. He always used to say people are out of tune with the planet and things like that. And he's saying, you know, the earth's in the wrong key at the moment.
Yeah, see, true.
And he's saying God can come along and say, okay, if you've got a key on the keyboard that doesn't work, you can miss that key off. And he used to say God can just miss that key off, get rid of earth. It's cocking up the whole...
Yeah.
It's cocking up the whole orchestra.
You know what I just thought of when you were saying that, bro? Do you remember Les Dawson? There's a comedian over here in the UK called Les Dawson. Do you remember he used to play the piano wonky? And he used to sing wonky and play the piano wonky. Like, if you're a comedian fan, I like comedy. So, like, if you check that, it's just... I just thought of that because sometimes it takes a little bit of someone stepping out the status quo and being like...
Well, I'd say Tim Vine or something. Is it Tim Vine? The comedian, the Vine. Is one of them's...
what's he do?
There's two, isn't there? It's a comedian.
Yeah.
I think it's Tim Vine.
What's the...
He just does one-liners, but then he does a little song here and there, and he just plays some stupid song. Mm. There's one something like pen behind the ear, and he's got a pen behind his ear, and he keeps on having to throw it and land it on the ear. And the music in the background, he's already pre-vocaled it, going, pen behind the ear. And it just repeats, and he misses and misses, and then occasionally he gets in, the crowd cheers, and then... because it's taken so long, he'll go, okay, let's try it with 2 pence.
And yeah.
I
mean, there's a guy.
It's almost
well.
Like slapstick. You know?
Yeah, totally. And there's a guy that I chatted on podcast. It's not on yet. It's going to come on soon. But a guy called Chris Turner, and he freestyle raps like. You know, he's like kind of like quite well-to-do guy. He's very, very much like this, you know. He's you wouldn't think he'd battle rap. Mm. And then all of a sudden, like, he'll be handing, you know, like Supernatural used to do back in the day. Like, that URL rap battle stuff. But he'll be given stuff and he'll be rapping about it. But he won't just rap. He's so good. Like, he's dangerously good. And he'll rap in raps with in and talk about this in its context and all sorts of stuff. But he puts it in a comedic form. So he's a comedian first and then a rapper.
Yeah.
Like that, again, it, like we were saying, pushes things that little bit more.
Yeah, it's like observational rhyming.
Yeah.
Like, here we are with Keller, wearing the glasses yellow. Just putting things in with the cup of tea. And I don't know, we should be wearing masks anyway, shouldn't we?
We've got this
corona thing going on all over the place.
That's what I say to everybody that comes on. You know, I say, it's either pixelation or mask. The corona's real out here.
where's your mask?
Where's your pixelation, man?
Yeah, we were joking about it last night. You could walk down the South Bank in one of them suits. That's what someone said, and get a corona logo off the beer bottle. Like made in Wuhan or something.
Oh
it was
God.
Just crazy.
Oh my God.
That's the kind of level it's got to. So I saw it on Instagram today. Someone had done,
done a
Mona
design.
Lisa in a gas mask.
Yeah.
And it said Corona Lisa or so. It's just ridiculous.
Oh my God.
It's just called stupid.
And was it the Cockney rhyming slang is, what is it? Miley Cyrus, virus. Coronavirus, Miley Cyrus. I mean, you know what I mean? It's extremely creative, isn't it? You know what I mean? When you think about the lengths people would... I think there's more platforms for creativity.
Anyone can be creative, isn't
it? Yeah.
That's
the good thing.
That's what the internet's opened up. Anyone can be creative, which is great.
Yeah.
But it's bad as well.
Yeah.
Because it's like things become to mean less.
They do become to mean less.
because it's like we're not bothered about it anymore. It's like if holograms are now here... And they're everywhere.
We'll forget about the real people.
After a day, like, oh, yeah, we can wait for holograms in the future.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, holograms have been out of day. Yeah, yeah, bored of them now. Yeah, you just put your hand through them. Yeah, don't know what else
Dolly Parton don't look like Dolly Parton no more.
Well, they've done Whitney Houston.
Oh, have they?
Whitney Houston now. You can go and see her on tour.
I was never a big Whitney Houston fan, you know. I mean, it might be controversial for my demographic, but, like, I was never a big... So demographic, my age
it's
range.
Pop music,
I mean, my age range.
It's just pop music for the masses, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if you don't consider yourself the masses, then it ain't for you.
Yeah. Do you think pop music and the like and technology is overconsumed us? Because what used to be not cool and pop is almost like intrinsic in our music and our culture. Mm. What do you think? I think it's kind of... It's all merged, isn't it?
Well, pop means is popular.
Yeah.
And everything's popular.
More so now than ever, doesn't it?
Yeah, everything available, everything at once.
Do you feel like you're lucky? I feel like I'm lucky that at least, like we're saying, the technology allows people to be observed and just come out of nowhere and be like these sensations with like a funny meme or a funny piece. But don't you feel like slightly lucky that...
I think we're too lucky because I feel a bit like, I can't remember who said it, but there's a whole thing about almost like if you've got too much democracy and freedom, it kind of defeats the object of what something is. Something may need a kind of more of an underground existence to contain any of its meaning or any real significance of what you do. Like same with the art thing, with the spray paint and whatever, you know, when it's everywhere, it's not got the same meaning as... Back in the day when you had to kind of visit a town, get a train there, climb over a fence to look at something, to take a photo.
Yeah, the glory.
And you ain't seeing that piece unless you visit it in the physical. Whereas now it's like everyone actually... It's almost like people paint walls now to be online.
Mm.
So it's kind of like probably even uploading the stages from beginning to end of the actual piece.
Yeah.
Then by the time it's finished... There it is. It's just another thing down the newsfeed, you know, in the ocean.
This is a concern, isn't it?
Trickling down.
I feel like it is a
concern.
Gone
tomorrow.
Yeah. I feel like it is a concern.
No, it's definitely a concern. What we need is a big solar flare from the sun to just knock out the grid, start over. Sounds harsh, sounds almost right-wing maybe, but in some ways it's kind of like culturally, I think we just hit a critical mass. It's kind of almost point zero.
It's a lot.
And part of my nature and styling of what I do is about finding new ways and new interpretations of things, everything I do. As soon as I do something and it makes its point, I try and move on. So I've always had a problem fitting in with all this kind of other stuff because it's always very, very much people find a niche and then repeat it and repeat it and make it their brand. Yeah. Whereas my brand is like constantly shifting, constantly shape-shifting. So people, it's harder for people to kind of lock it down into their little markets, which I'm fine with. You know, I'm their market is their market. Yeah. My market is my market. My market is not being in their market. Yeah. So,
yeah, and you know what? It's actually, it's refreshing to hear, but it's also if you calculate what you're doing right, it's sustainable. Mm. Yeah. You can live off of being off grid. You can survive by being individual.
I mean, I could follow the markets and be a whole lot richer. I can pretty much know how to manipulate all of that if I really wanted to, but it's not me.
It's not fun.
Exactly, it's no fun. To me, making anything, whether it be through art, visually, or sonically, through music, whatever, making anything to me is about exploring. It's the exploring, and almost like getting some equipment or some paint materials and working out how to joyride them, you know, take them for a joyride, you know.
Do you think that takes a strength in character and belief? Do you think that's like a real... Do you have to be really hard...
Seems so. Yeah. It's quite a lonely place.
Because you're a very... Yeah, it will be.
Yeah, it's a lonely place, you know. I've got my drinking down to solitary drinking. I see it as a solitary sport now.
Do you?
Yeah. I nicked that off, I think it was Forrest Whitaker, off one of his films.
So the drinking is your medicine, your business. You keep it solid.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. I don't mean it in a real alcoholic sense, but I'm just saying, I'm pretty much, I like being in my own
company.
Realm, really. Yeah. I mean, I'm social.
Yeah, of course you are.
I'm a social creature.
No, but I think we all...
I don't want to be part of all this other hedonist kind of
Well, I have to admit, right, when Dave Budgeon, big up Dave again, hit me up and said, yo, fuck it, I'm boys with part two, do you know part two? And I was like, bro, I used to tour with the guy. Like, me and him got stories of days, right? And
New York.
Right? There's explaining this story. So we went on tour, like, 1999, wasn't it? 2000, something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
With Ninja Tune, and it was us, there was Vadim, DJ Vadim, who's been on the podcast, Roots Maneuver, DJ MK, and I think, to my knowledge, maybe even Cinematic Orchestra.
I don't think they were on that tour.
No?
Dynamic Syncopation.
Yes.
There was two of them.
That's the one. And it was a mixed match of all different things. I think Kikwala did a couple of dates and then... But we went...
Went all over.
Yeah, we went all over. And it was my first time in a big bus as well. It was like a fucking big deal. And there were sections, wasn't there?
You've got to sleep the right way up. Because when it breaks, like if your head's facing the front, your head butt the wall.
But this is New Flesh for Old and we were out partying and doing our thing. We were in New York, weren't we? But I didn't remember this story.
It was a different gig. We were there for another reason. I didn't even know you were there. I think all it was we'd gone to Ram LZ's. The story was Ram was big on his drink. He pulled out the beers. Then his wife turned up later with a bottle of vodka. Then they had weed without the tobacco, some really heavy stuff. And I didn't really smoke much weed, so when I hit a few, I kind of almost forgot. And then I think it hit my stomach and I did what they call throwing a whitey.
Yeah.
So there's one point I had to hang out of his window and the window was the wrong height. So you couldn't lean over the window ledge.
Oh, no.
You couldn't kneel down. Yeah. So my legs were in some really contorted, weird position. I was just watching planes landing in Newark Airport.
No way.
Over the water. And then I thought I was going to be sick. So I ended up locking myself in his bathroom. And I think I was in there for hours and it was just loads of his neon masks just staring at me. And I'm just holding onto bath taps going, oh, come on, be sick. And he wouldn't.
Yeah.
And then
I hate that feeling, though.
And then we kind of left there. And Ju Salim turned up. He was on a later flight and wanted to go out. By the time we got to this club in East Village, I was just like, I just found a massive speaker scoop. Mm-hmm. And there's a little space behind it and a bit of bench. And I just kind of fell asleep on it. And it was, I remember it was someone going, Keith, and it was you who woke me up. And I was like, I know your face. Why are you here? Why are you waking me up?
Dude, I don't remember. And you were just like, this was the alarm clock.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
I was
saying Killer Keller was an alarm clock. And then and it's weird, they were on the mics. They'd got on. They weren't even meant to be playing there. They'd ended up on the mics. Now you were waking me up. Toasty and Ju Salim were rocking some mics with the crowd going mad.
And you were just laying out. How did you know we were there? Or did you not know?
No, I didn't. We just ended it accidentally happened to be in that club.
Well, motherfucker.
Because someone had said something to somebody, there's a thing down there tonight, because we weren't due to play until the following night. So we were there 3 days for like a half an hour gig.
That's crazy. but it's always worth it.
Yeah. Wait. So we'd end up in that club. But, I think the jet lag and then also the me being wrecked just messed me up. And I think the next day, apparently I'd made Ram have to urinate in his own sink because I'd locked the bathroom door.
No way.
And Toasty was going, Keith, you know what happened last night? You made Ram pee in his sink. But are you going to ring him about the gig because he doesn't know where he is? And I went, I couldn't ring him. I was like, I'm too embarrassed.
No way. I didn't
ring him again until I got back to the UK. And he went, everything's cool. It's cool.
Bless
him. I was just too so embarrassed with it all.
Aww. By the way, fucking amazing story. Amazing. How was Ramelsey? I mean, rest in peace. How was Ramelsey? Was he a good people?
How was
he as a character?
Oh, it was great. He was everything as a character. Yeah. That's what he was. He was a character. He was who he said he was. That's what's interesting. All that stuff you read about his mythology and the stuff he talks, that's him. He almost lives by it. He was the gothic futurist monk. Whatever he said he was.
Yeah. He literally embodied the things he made.
Yeah, he became his own myth. He transcended the whole Hugh man thing that he used to call it, like Hugh as in Hugh color and all of that. Human race, what are they in a race for? All these kind of little philosophies.
Yeah, did you get into the philosophies with
him? I understood them. Mm. Yeah, and they were here. Some of them means more to me than others. Some maybe I'm a bit like, I'm not so bothered about that or whatever, you know. I mean, the whole thing of armour in letters, I totally get it. The whole thing about him, armour in letters to try and destroy the infinity symbol or whatever it was. And for me, I kind of understand it in terms of the development of Wildstyle, of the arrows being missiles. And when they were on the trains, they were like, the rolling pages.
Yeah.
And they were arming themselves against the next piece, the whole battle thing. But
that's incredible. What?
For me, he saw it as a life philosophy. And my thing is, well, hang on, that's a little bit like civil war in it. Why don't you just transcend the letters and create a new language?
Yeah.
That's more my take on it. But it's weird because a lot of people he preached to, always preached. People went to his place in New York and he just preached to them. Mm. His whole philosophy, almost indoctrination.
For real?
Whereas with me, he didn't do that. We just kind of walked around and mucked about and just had rhyming battles about any old stupid thing,
What was his house like? Was it literally wall-to-wall?
The battle station was. When that closed down because they were selling the building. I think he went for years without even paying rent on that place.
Really?
On the battle station. Yeah, that's why he did a track called Pay Your Rent. It's based on the whole thing. I think he used to hide every time they came or whatever, but no one could get him out of there. That's just what he told me. He used to say he never paid rent. He used to use the rooftop as well. And apparently he used to go on about it. He's always up there with his slingshot. I'm like, what's the slingshot for? He's like, I don't like the Samaritans or something. He used to slingshot the Samaritans off his rooftop.
Tell you what, man. When I think New York...
He's a funny guy.
Yeah, when I think New Yorkian of a creative nature of our era...
He was kind of one of the last few of that generation from that kind of the old downtown scene.
Yeah.
And William Burroughs even and all of that,
Totally.
And we lost FaZe.
Yeah, rest in peace,
recently
FaZe
as well.
Yes, you knew him as an acquaintance too, right?
An acquaintance, not from years though. My partner was in touch with him quite a lot on a pen pal basis, actually. She was very much in touch with him in the last year or two, whereas like my last contact with him was probably like 2010. He wrote a foreword for a catalogue. Uh-huh. So I knew him briefly. I mean, for me, Ram was more like my close buddy,
if you
know what I mean. So, I didn't really have that kind of thing with FaZe.
It's just a warm, fuzzy idea. I was a little bit younger than that. I know these as names, but even me, that feeling of that era of New York, you can touch it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's such a, you say, and John Michelle, and just that whole era of New York being extremely creative, the rap scene, the punk scene. This, you know, it's touchable, it's tangible, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was, there was something real about it in not real as in a keep it real kind of thing, in a very authentic way. There was something more authentic about it, but in some ways, it's a kind of grassroots DIY ethos coming head to head with that, almost the kind of fashion scene. So there's the kind of real and unreal, you know what I mean? But then, you know. But it all works, you know. I mean, Grace Jones and all of that, you know, these things. I mean, she was the ultimate pop star, really.
Yeah, for real.
You know, in terms of...
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. You know, there's nothing else that rivals that authoritative, you know, diva, I'm doing this, you know what I mean? And it's when I think of Whitney Houston, these are just like two different worlds, man. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, when you talk about maverick pop and, you know, don't give a fuck, like, you don't... They don't breed. Mm. They don't breed people like that.
Yeah, because even the pop back then around the times of Grace Jones, it was all, most of it, all the good pop stuff, probably maybe half of it, or maybe a bit less, was kind of post-punk, which was actually good stuff, whether it be Talking Heads, B-52s, you know, there was actually good pop music.
Two-tone kind of cracked in from over here. Were you a two-tone fan?
Two-tone. Mm. And when I was a kid, I remember all the two-tone stuff, specials, AKA and stuff. Mm. Yeah, it was kind of interesting, because that was just all the happy accident of... people maybe being into Don Letts playing reggae over here in punk venues and people kind of getting into the reggae thing and trying to copy it and getting it wrong. Mm. And in some ways you had... it wasn't ska as you knew it from Jamaica, but it was a kind of new ska, post-ska, I don't know, whatever you want to call it. But it had its own thing. And I think in some ways, you know... Even in this country, some of the rap stuff is maybe that now, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of it
is,
yeah.
The grime stuff or whatever. Yeah. It's kind of like, it's very much, if you're ever looking for a real UK hip-hop, you're probably there.
It's probably
even though it's not UK hip-hop in the sense of UK hip-hop. And it's almost like another thing, completely other generation. Yeah. And there's almost like not much holistic connection anymore.
Yeah.
But in some ways, whether you like the lyrics or the lyric content or not, whatever, you know, that is a generation's music in the same way Breaking or whatever was to us in the 80s or something, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
We have to, you know, otherwise we're like our old parents going, what's that racket you're playing?
Yeah. Which normally means it's good.
You're doing spinning on your head, you'll go bald.
Yeah, it's the same thing now with drill and rap and Afrobeat to a point, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of...
You've got the old hip-hop heads going, what's this?
Yeah. And I kind of like that.
It's perplexing me.
Yeah, and I like that. It's just, you know, you've got to feed
good.
Yeah, and let a younger generation take...
But then they're right to complain about it too.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, we don't have to be part of that. We can just watch it all, watch them be more successful with 50 million... YouTube views and watch the old heads moaning with their 100 views.
I mean, here's the thing, and that's another fact. Like, with in grime, for instance, the forerunners are still the forerunners of grime now are still of the age they were there when they started
it.
It's very rare that as an organism and a scene... Still continues. Like, if Sex Pistols had just kept on going, would they still be the forerunners now of punk? You don't know. But Wiley and Lethal Bizzle and all these people, they're still at the table, which kind of makes the DNA relevant. But like, if you'd have turned around to Wiley and say, like, who's your favourite rapper? And he said, Jadakiss. Or he says, you know, my favourite, what I grew up on was, I don't know, fucking Grandmaster Flash. You'd just blow your mind.
It's totally different things.
Kind of makes it relevant again.
But that's the thing. I mean, what we've got to remember is sometimes we've got to forget all these categories and titles. That's why I keep saying I like to try and broaden things out and stay away from the kind of categories.
Because it all feeds.
Because the main thing, any of this new stuff's got in common with what we were doing in the 80s, 90s, or wherever, or New York people in the 70s. End of the day, the main emphasis is all about just empowering yourself.
Yes.
Taking control of a situation that's not necessarily good.
Fact.
Maybe the area you live in, the family or the kind of code you're born into, which you didn't have a say about.
Yeah, yeah.
You were just born into it.
Yeah.
And you're trying to find a way out. You can either stay in that same thing, in that same condition or state. Or you can try and do something to empower yourself, and that was what kind of the painting was for us.
Yeah.
We didn't need to ask permission. We could, if we didn't have permission to do something on a space in public anyway. We take that space at night or whatever. And the same thing we like, you know, the whole, even the rap music thing, taking samples from a record or two copies of a record, just a drum beat on a record. It's like, we don't have any instruments, we don't have any money, but we can make a beat with two copies. And this guy can come along and write him on it. And then we got people dancing as well, and a guy painting. We, you know.
And they're doing it without permission. Fuck you. Do you think that? Do you think the institution that street culture and
well, street
music,
art in particular? Yeah, whatever you call to say it. Right now, that is an institution.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's slowly breeding and it's building a foundations, isn't
and
it?
And I think even as graffiti, as an order, if people want to stay kind of really, really in a purist mindset about it, then that becomes an institution.
It does, yeah.
All an institution is.
That's what I'm getting from this conversation.
It's a code of conduct and a set of rules,
yeah.
A kind of rubric of,
you
don't do that. That's not considered
hardcore
what
enough.
We do.
Yeah.
And you don't do that, but you do this, and then you get the pat on the back, and then you get respect. But then if you go over me, we've got beef. And all of these things. But at the end of the day, really, it's the same in all circles. You know, you make a competitive things on a kind of business level in another area of these arts, whatever. In some ways, it holds people back because I think what makes people strong, similar to the mafia or whatever back in the day, was it's all about kind of strengthening numbers.
Yes. Which are ultimately, in a tribal sense,
we spend a lot of time kind of beefing with each other, which I think some way pulls the whole thing down, really.
Yeah.
And probably why a lot of things like UK rap back in the day wasn't successful.
That's right, yes.
A lot of artists from this country aren't as well known as other people in Europe or America or whatever, because people, it's like the crab in the barrel syndrome all the time, you know?
Yeah. Caught maybe the last pinches of that coming into... Because I came in from a UK hip hop scene, you know, but it wasn't. There was elements of it I didn't like.
Mm.
That's why when Ninja Tune, who were extremely progressive at their time and quite forward thinking in terms of broken beats, instrumental stuff, and any rapper that I would meet that is into that shit, I automatically bonded with because I just felt like it wasn't. We weren't all. Linear soldiers of like having to talk the way other rappers would.
I mean,
not from there.
Say with the Big Dada Ninja Tune thing, when we signed with them, whatever. Yeah. I mean, we did some stuff independently first, but I never went into that wanting to make any trip hop or anything.
Mesopotamia.
I was just
that
doing
tune
my,
that you guys
my own
did.
Thing, yeah,
that Mesopotamia.
Yeah, Maneuver used to go on about that. I remember one day he was doing a photo shoot with him, and he kept humming that bass line.
Yeah.
And then
a year later,
I ended up getting passed witness to remix.
That
I'm like, right, he's got something from that company. He's using the electronic bass sounds, but that to see in his whole things. So it's funny that he a year before he was stood next to me doing a photo shoot. He went on for 10 minutes. He's going, well, how's it go again? Doing the Mesopotamia thing.
Yeah.
He's going, yeah. How do you make an acid bass line work with jazz sounds, Keith?
Yeah. It was incredible.
And
so
I got
so
witness
you...
to Mick, but it's just interesting that distribution of ideas. That's how things. Work and they operate better when you're not really too set on trying to make one or any specific thing. It's just, it is what
this
it is.
This is legendary talk.
You know.
This is so for those you don't know, and I wanted to get this in before you went into the story, but like, fucking check out New Flesh for Old Mesopotamia. As Keith says, it's
1995,
yeah,
I think that was.
That kind of spawned inspiration and ideas for Roots Move Witness as a beat.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, we would say
and then you
so.
Remixed
we'd
it.
We'd say so. Rodney did actually ring me up once 3 years ago or something and just randomly out of the blue, he just called me.
That's
randomly.
Normally how he does it.
He does, yeah, he does. And he randomly called me. I think I'd missed a call from him at something like 4 a.m. or something when I was asleep and then got me in the morning and he just went, part two, yeah. I just want to say I owe you some royalties. I thought I was... doing this, but I learned it from you. I owe you royalties. And I'm
amazing.
Like, and someone said, did he give you any royalties? And I told someone. I went, no. He was only just being Rodney.
Yeah.
he was never going to pay any royalties.
It starts with the 4 o'clock call. And
he just felt like he needed to... Maybe he kept him awake for one evening.
Yeah.
And he just thought he needed to say
it. Mate, those things that keep you awake for one evening, man. I mean, it's... Right, so... Let's go back very slightly because, you know, we're really dropping some fucking science right here. So where are you from? Where did it begin? Where's your... What's your, like, yeah, come on, let's get into the... the bare bones.
I grew up in York. In the north, yeah. Mm. And I think back in the day when we started about 1984, so it was that really primitive, primal stuff. And I remember, you remember when you can there'd be an outline, you'd have two cans, two colours, an orange and a blue. You do a blue outline, fill it in orange after you've already done the outline, and then put blue highlights an inch away from the outline, the same colour or something. Really? You know, really primitive, primal looking stuff.
How did you get away with that in York? Because York's a very, very...
I did a load. I did... The first one I did was on the back of a shopping arcade.
It's beautiful, York.
And a friend
lovely
of mine
place.
Chipped it off. He actually, because the wall was a bit flaky, he chipped it off out of jealousy.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
I did another one down a sticky on a breeze block wall. And then we met some people uptown who were doing stuff, joined forces, and we just went out doing train bridges every weekend. So it's still at school. Go to school and we go on a train to Leeds Market.
There you go.
Because they had these DIY shops that sold loads of car paint, but they kept them in boxes at the front of the counter. Uh-huh. Now the counter's like maybe 4 foot high. So all we'd do is, right, turn up with a, you know, the old school headbags. And we'd have some of the two of us go out, you talk to them, ask for whatever's behind them that they have to turn around and get.
To a science.
To say, oh, can I have a look at that screwdriver? And when he's at, no, not the yet, the blue one sort of thing.
Amazing.
And we'd be down the bottom. Grrr. So we weren't just nicking cans, putting them down your leg or under your hat or in your sleeve or whatever, because we did do that.
You were doing massive sports bags.
We were like, we need to get proper, we need enough to make, so then we could do like peace Saturday daytime somewhere, something Saturday night, and then Sunday.
Amazing.
Before we go back to school and get like 4 or 5 pieces so we'd fill the head bag. I think we used to get away with that loads of times.
I would imagine there wasn't many people that would be racking.
One time, an old woman clocked us. I think people probably did clock us but didn't want to say anything. But this, you get these people, don't you? The old woman. Oi!
Yeah.
They're nicking your paint. And then we had to zip the bag up and leg it. We didn't leave the paint. I think we even kind of... stuck another box worth in.
See ya!
And we got chased. Some guys tried to chase us through Leeds off the stalls or something.
Not happening.
But
yeah.
we lost them. Because Leeds was the kind of place where there was loads of different indoor arcades. You could run across one main road and into another one.
Yeah, it's still like that as well.
But we would do that and then we'd go back to York and then paint or whatever, you know. So that was our little...
Don't shit on your doorstep, kids.
That was our place. That was our... But yeah, we never painted. We did do it. When I first started, I did the local health surgery. Because he had a really massive, big, white tiled wall right up the entrance that was just facing a car park.
Right, yeah.
And you could see it from the main road and did it at night. But one of the kids from my school, his dad was a copper and they knew it was me. And it was, I think it was called Alwyn Smith. Alwyn Smith's after
you. Never forget
you.
A name.
Yeah. Alwyn Smith, say. He knows you did it. Can't prove it, but he knows you did it. And I think he was there for maybe a week and then they somehow got it cleaned off, whatever. So that was shitting on the doorstep.
Yeah.
I think most of the times I got caught, whatever, tagging when it was in my own local area, to be honest.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make sense to shit on your doorstep. They're the only times I ever got kind of caught. And there were coppers who knew me.
Mm.
So there's no point even running. It's just like, you got me.
When did you... So you were caught... Very much like me, actually, you know what I mean? Because the area that I grew up in was too small. So you've got to start...
I started travelling, getting trains out. I think it was more after the crew days with the early 80s.
Mm.
And then it kind of went into a smaller crew. A lot of those people weren't really very good at art or painting. And
so then
they were a bit more hooligan-y, you know. One guy in particular was more of like a kind of Leeds football firma sort of youngster. He was a bit older than us, but he was kind of like about to leave school sort of age.
Yeah.
And kind of the circles got a bit smaller.
Mm.
And then after that, kind of went more into a solo thing from like 87 or something. And then started travelling around a lot more, going to Birmingham and going to Manchester or going to London and, you know, meeting other writers, whatever, and painting in other cities. And then, I never really saw myself as belonging to any particular place or scene then. It was just I turn up and paint. Mm. And... which was hard to do back then because it's not the transient, like London in particular, it's not the transient place it is now, where you've got people passing through in and out.
You can paint in
London in the 80s.
You couldn't?
No, not if you wanted to get robbed or something. You could if you knew people.
Right.
You had to know people.
Yeah. And stand up for your own, I suppose.
That was it. I mean, I remember painting in 89, I think, was the first time I painted in London. Because back then, no one really... But people from Nottingham, Sheffield, everyone went to London, took boat, but no one really put a piece down. because you didn't know anyone, especially Peyton around Grove. There was always a lot of robbing going on and all of that.
Going into the pit and stuff like that. Yeah. Last thing you want to do.
I remember 15 guys in there. We'll run in that pit. Two of them will block the doorway into it.
Because only one way in.
Then they just go through whoever's pockets they want. Bro. I remember it was mad. It was always cameras.
I remember going in there.
Decent cameras. Yeah. Money, whatever.
Bro, I remember going in there for the first time. It must have been like 99 or something. Mm. I mean, we're talking
99.
Yeah, long
time. So that's quite late. I'm talking like 87.
Yeah, totally.
I remember the first time I went there, I was probably 13, 14 years old as well.
It would have been a different landscape.
I wouldn't even mention it. I was like jumping on trains half fair from the north.
Yeah.
Turning up at King's Cross, jumping on a tube, whatever. And going to grow, I was like a kid.
Yeah.
You know, most kids don't even hang out in another kid's neck of the woods because there'd be trouble.
I remember going into that pit and no one was in there but me, maybe four or five mates. We're all from out of town. Mm. We're all there just to see, get the Kodaks going and start taking photos.
Yeah.
And as I was taking photos, it was like a cinematic moment how I imagined it in my head. But I kind of put my camera down. I see everyone like around me taking photos, flashes. And I look around and I'm like, hold on a minute. We're downstairs in a ballpark, and there's only one entrance in, and one entrance out.
Oh, it's perfect.
We need to get the fuck out of here. We need to get the fuck out of here.
I mean, the way that was set up in the '80s. I don't know whether I should say names or what. I mean, foam was one name. If anyone knew anything about foam, they'll know what I'm talking about. Don't even need to say no more.
Okay.
That's that bit done and dusted.
Okay.
and other names as well. But that was the thing. There were some people who lived in certain blocks near, say, Westbourne Park Tube Station, and they'd know when new pieces had gone up. Oh, right, payday this weekend. So they'd kind of see people come out the tube so they could see them.
No way.
I mean, in an area like that, back then, you could spot new faces who didn't belong or weren't from there. You knew they were there. Yeah, alternative. These were alternative tourist destinations. People didn't necessarily go to London to see Big Ben or Buckingham Palace. Yeah. Some people went to go to Ladbroke Grove
to see
put their money in their socks on the way in or whatever. Yeah. Whatever they wanted to do. Not that it's a very good hiding place. No. but that was it. And it's perfect because you block the door. People are locked in. You ain't going nowhere.
Yeah.
But your whim is just like, right, what you got?
Alternative tourist spots.
What's in your pocket? Yeah. Great. And it was just payday.
Mm. So it's not like that, is it?
So many things are different about them days because even the pieces then.
Yeah.
Lasted maybe 6 months before
it'd
only go when a certain amount of pen tags would get more and more, and then it'd be like, someone's put glasses on the character now or whatever, let's emulsion it and do a new one. And it was a lot of the same people, whether it be Bunny and them guys nonstop or All Star Kings or Scam. Casby, Foam, whatever, but they all knew each other, innit?
Yeah.
So that's what I mean, smaller circles than you got now.
Mm.
Now it's anyone.
I was speaking to Syme, he's on a podcast, and he was saying, Grem, and what's it called? Trellick. When you go down to them places now, like a lot of the graph, they don't actually last that long. At all.
A day, maybe.
Yeah, it's almost like...
It's literally paint, get your photo. It's almost got its own new... That's the new... Yeah. That's the modern day rule book, I think, is... paint your piece, take your photos.
And then get the fuck out.
And that's it. But if you expect it to last, you've got no argument.
But then it's like, for a piece, it could cost up to like 40 quid now you're paying for cans. So what's the... How does that incentivize
you? Is your Instagram account. That's what I was talking about earlier. Yeah. But you're more or less, you're painting the wall. But really, its lifespan is all about it existing in that kind of, cyberspace, basically. And its currency is in cyberspace in terms of likes and comments and whatnot, generating likes and followers. That's the economy of it. And in some ways, that's capitalism's little takeover of culture and spray canisms or whatever. It's subject to capitalist reign and rule, really. And that's it. Globalization is very much concrete. It's funny how someone said this old academic lecturer once. Funny how people can predict the end of the world, but no one can predict the end of capitalism, it's that kind of thing, isn't it? I remember when I heard that, I was like, you see that guy in the town square, the end is nigh and all this, and it's kind of like, nothing in terms of capitalism. Capitalism comes down. That's it. It's war. It's just war. It's hell.
Yeah, hell.
That is hell. You're getting sent to hell. be around when capitalism dies.
Yeah, dude.
When that bomb goes off, you know.
That's cold.
I think that was what William Burroughs as well said, don't think about being around when their shithole blows up. Yeah. in that voice. Don't think about being around. I can't do those accent things.
Do you envisage because with my podcast, right? I mean, a lot of people may or may not know this, but everything that I do with the podcast is from scratch. It goes from I make the music that's the soundtrack to it, the intro music, then I'll do all of this, and then I'll go and edit it, and then I'll do all the trailers, I'll do everything from the subtitles, you know, right down to the wire.
Yeah.
There's something incredibly although my thing is like I'm a conduit to other guests and artists coming on, and I want to know all about them, the back line of it is entirely my creative space. Mm. Do you see, and I'm coming to something here.
Yeah, yeah.
You will have
come
rolled
with
up.
It.
Yeah.
Come
do
with
you
it.
Feel like the all-encompassing artist in you, now we're talking about the creation of the instrumental, the creation of the music, the end result, the product, the graffiti, the illustration, the artwork behind the piece, the thing that becomes the record cover itself in many cases. And then there's you that embodies that both sides of it. Like, do you think we both share a very similar structure and way of working. You know, everything counts in the creative arena. Do you think that, like, is part, or rather the lack of some creatives' identities, is that they don't fulfill the overall commitment of, like, if you can do a piece, do the soundtrack for the piece. If you're going to do something, embody it, you as a person, like Ramel Z would. Do you know what I mean? Do you think that is lacking?
I think it's going to lack. It's always going to lack for that very reason. But you're born into it. You're born into a system where everything is accessible and available and anyone can upline. Like, I mean, you know, props to you for your podcast. It's the success of your podcast. But anyone can make a podcast.
Exactly, yeah.
From their bedroom.
100%. You know? Yeah, yeah.
Just to use that as an example. Yeah. And this is everything in culture. Yeah. Anyone with money can open a coffee shop. You don't have to be Costa or Nero, you know. Yeah. Anyone can make music on a laptop. You don't need a studio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So
this is what I'm thinking. Like, why wouldn't a graffiti writer... Like, Trap House, I don't know if you've heard of a guy called Trap House, but he's made... He does tattoos, he does graffiti, but he's also doing his own music. And there's something really, celebrating about that. Something really, like... taking advantage of all these different creative mediums. And I love the idea of a graph writer having, like you do, having your music that represents your art.
Well, I wish I was younger, you know. I'd like to come at... I'd love to come at things again from another angle.
Yeah.
I mean, even with... we were talking about trains earlier. I mean, I painted a train in 1985, and it was easy. Jump over a little wall that was about maybe 5 foot high. They're all concrete slab walls. And you're in a yard. Now, but it's raised.
Mm-hmm.
So to get away, it's easier to jump over the wall and run off into the wilderness or a state or whatever. And some of them layups were like that. I remember painting a train. It was just there in the layup. No one was going to get us, because to get through, you had to come from one end of the side of the train because of the length of the train.
Mm.
That's their only point of entry, unless they want to crawl underneath. But they've got to see us first.
Yeah.
And there's a wall behind us or whatever. You know, I remember doing it. And the reason I never really did trains, but I did about maybe one in Sheffield after that. In the 80s, but from that moment in time, I didn't know about anyone in London painting tubes or anything. To me, I was just trying to copy the Style Wars thing. And let's do a train, you know. And you're probably like, okay, you probably got Ramo in your head, it's the white one, and it's like, nah, this is a blue slam door. And I think there was an embarrassment about doing it, kind of like, yeah, just me and my friend in this yard on our own painting this slam door, nothing else on, no other mark on it. It's not quite New York, is it?
Yeah,
it felt a bit embarrassing. I remember we'd been painting some walls, and the four of us, and the other two had gone off. We'd gone off, walked away, that goes past those yards, but they had the camera. We didn't, so they didn't get a photo of it. And the following weekend, went back to find a photo. We couldn't find the train. Everywhere in that yard, going round between all the different carriages, like, God knows where it is. And I didn't like the fact that I can't... What's the word? I can't contain it.
Yeah.
To get a photo or all of that.
There's not enough control for you.
Yeah. And it wasn't like there was any train scene or anything or there. I mean, I wasn't aware of who else might be painting trains in other parts of the country or London or whatever or in Europe.
But you felt like a little dot in the thing.
Just a tiny little dot, and it almost like yeah, stupid imitation. Like the blue slam door is hardly, doesn't that quite have the glamour of the New York subway in this crack-ridden city? It just felt a bit kind of like a bit phony. I felt phony.
I get you.
So I never really pursued that. And I suppose in those early days, 85 and stuff, the big influence back then was seeing things in Covent Garden by Chrome Angels and Pride and everybody and even the stuff down Grove and those kind of like, you know,
bun-like kind of
styles with all the shines and all of that and the little inverse upside down kind of. I started getting into all that kind of futuristic kind of. It was kind of like, I think Pride called it. I remember saying to Pride, how would you describe that stuff back then? We just thought it was futuristic. And he said, he just looked at it as like, it's more, it's just like an impressionist version of New York. It's more impressionism.
Whoa,
I thought that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Twist on that.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of thought, I get that. It is almost like, you know, there might be a pink bunt like outline with white highlights rather than a big chunky fat black outline like you'd have seen in New York. It was all very much big because you're painting big cars, a big fat outline, whatever. And I thought in Britain it kind of it moved a bit somewhere else and it became a bit more like this fusion of colours, almost like maybe it's not as wild style as say a Case 2, which is more
crazy.
It's got more of an illustrative kind of definite line.
Yeah.
Whereas this stuff, because it didn't have a definite line, it looked more complicated or wild style, because it was like the colours would blow your senses. And I think that had a bigger influence on me, and I suppose my embarrassment was different. So I never really moved into those kind of territories as much. But that's why I always say people have got different experiences. There's no point trying to be anyone else but yourself. And I think if you want to talk about keeping it real, like Roberta Flack once sung, keep it real. Compared to what, you know, it's to me the art gives me some kind of way of interpreting things, interpreting life.
Yeah.
It's all hermeneutics, the art of interpretation, basically, and that's what it's all about. And I think
feeding it through.
It's very difficult in a time now when almost everything is derivative by default.
Yeah.
So if everything is derivative by default, the best way of changing things is not so much like I mean, some people might just do a letter thing and go, let's do a different character, because no one's ever done a character like that on a train. But it's not a big enough change. I think it needs to be conceptually.
Yeah.
And if I was coming at it now from a younger point of view, I'd probably, just off the top of my head,
these
aren't definite ideas that I would totally do, but I'd think, okay, what can I do to a train? Okay, I like the idea of if people look at this graph thing as being, like, predictable, it's more graph. It'd just be... It's just more noise, isn't it? More white noise.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you painted a whole car black and got some of that sticker stuff and tinted the windows, black tinted window, then it's kind of like, hey, who repainted the car?
Yeah.
They almost start ringing in amongst their own authorities trying to work out why that car's black. Mm-hmm. Well, it can't be a vandal. Who the hell would want to do that?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the head scratch of it all.
Yeah.
But from a conceptual point of view, I mean, you could stick huge vinyl text on there of certain slogans across the whole lot. They're saying something, whether it be political, geopolitical, something about London or just something about anything, really. This changes.
Like the idea of the rap.
It's changing the way you look at it. We don't have to. Why do we have to be restricted to just using spray paint anyway? Yeah. There's other ways to be subversive. And I think when spray paint fails to be subversive anymore because you see it all and it all becomes like part of the wallpaper in the background, you know, I don't want to preach because some people might say, oh, fuck this dude, Keith. What's he talking about here? I'm just graff for life. Fine. You know what I mean? But
if quote-unquote terrorism and quote-unquote vandalism is the thing, then why would it be stuck on this one medium?
Yeah, and it isn't necessarily all about the vandalism. I mean, a lot of people, I remember saying is something on a Facebook post years ago about... do you consider what you do political, like a state's thing? And a lot of people were like, no, I'm just into bombing, I'm just into that. I don't see myself as political. And they were looking at the question wrong. They were looking at it as like, nah, I don't make political statements with what I do. I just tag my name. And the point of the status was, yeah, but it's a political act. Because it's not supposed to be there. So it's your statement on, like, fuck London Transport, fuck this city. I'm here, and I want to write my name there. Yeah. That is a political statement. Yeah, that's the thing. And that's it. I don't think a lot of people always necessarily have a full understanding of what they do on a kind of wider context. But in some ways, in terms of we could make it go a whole lot further, way beyond the corporate control. Because even corporate companies can now can use a bit of vandalist-looking graffiti as an aesthetic to make their product look a bit more edgy.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we could start doing things. We can you turn the colours of a tube into Jamaican colours and keep them in the same place so it's almost like it almost looks official? Just a mess.
You know who
with
fucked
their
with that
heads.
Really well? You know who fucked with that? Solo One did really good.
Yeah,
the sticker,
yeah.
The sticker campaign was incredible.
But that's it.
Dude, I remember going on. I'd go out on nights with him. He would do different campaigns. This was at a time where stickering was new to brands and companies, but he was the go-to guy, and there wasn't any legislations or any weirdness about it. So his thing was like, I remember we were walking down the road, and he would get a sticker. It was a tiny sticker. I'm like, yeah. We'll talk about this one podcast or another. And he stuck it. It's the same size as the barcode on the bus advertisement board the bus stop. And I was like, what are you doing there? And he goes, well, they're brands, aren't they? I'm going to fucking stick it on their barcode so when the guy comes around trying to get it won't work. It's just these little details of like...
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, man, that's a lot of thinking. But it just made... Logical, anarchic, for no good reason sense. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, there was a thing years ago, you'd be out just having a few beers with people and stuff, and you might be like, what if everybody in one whole country wrote the same thing?
Yeah.
And just bombed everywhere. Yeah. Who do you catch then?
Yeah.
Are you so-and-so? Were you... Everyone is so-and-so.
That's just amazing.
You can't catch him. Because he's everyone.
He's
everywhere.
Like Coca-Cola is.
It's that kind of thing, you know. It's finding new ways to do things. But, yeah, we could kind of say, is it limited to the medium of spray paint? Or can we do other things? Can you take the roofs off them all? So there's no roofs and make them open and put something to do with an open top thing. I mean, these are maybe a bit stupid or...
Yeah, but that's what creates...
Silly, but it's just the idea of how far we haven't gone, really. There's a lot of simple things and simple ways of looking at things where you could probably have more effect in subverting things and arresting people mentally, well, engaging them in new ways. Because I think... if something's been seen for 30 years and it's the same style time to time, it's gonna like a virus, isn't it? It becomes immune to the antibiotics, you know, or something. You know, people become immune to being engaged with certain types of work or whatever.
What's inspiring you at the moment? Who's out there that you're just... Or rather, actually, no, let's be broader than that. What are your all-time inspirations? What are the people that you're like, because you were in VOP for a minute. You had your TAN crew. You had all these different things that you would.
Well, I was in VOP because I was in Iconoclast, and VOP were part of that. And I think I did a few things down there in London, and it was a link to doing stuff in London at the time. And I think, that, like I said earlier, I think they just wanted me in because of the I did good photorealism or something. So it was a bit like get him on board, or whatever. But yeah, I think that all thing split up.
TAN sounded crazy though.
TAN was my main thing, really. So it was the Aerosol Nation, which was me, System, Shine from Manchester, from the Style Stars.
Rest in peace,
Rob Elliott, Juice 126.
Crazy writer.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is like, that's real.
That's the proper lineup.
Like,
that's
like, you're not meant to drip paint? What? I'll drip the whole wall, mate, all the way down, and I'll use like 50.
You still can't
cans
fuck with Juice now.
Wall.
Juice is still crazy.
Exactly. And people are trying to pin all this stuff into this kind of like spray paint in the contemporary art world, post vandalism, and all these things that don't even really make sense. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
Even I didn't even like that graph futurism thing. All of these things that just don't make sense, and it's all people kind of trying to appropriate all these things. No one's talking about, hang on, we did this as the Iconoclast movement back from the late 80s, and it's kind of like filling whole walls with drips. Yeah. Now you've got crink.
Does everything have
now,
to have
yeah,
a reason?
Now you've got crink, and now you've got Risk in LA, painting with Scene, doing that style as whole background on 100-foot walls up a cherry picker.
Yeah, yeah.
And no one's giving that to Juice.
No.
And the same thing.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
And again, we're just highlighting there's no rules. Like, why does it have to be a reason for something? It's like, it's complete and utter fun.
He didn't want to paint letters, that's it.
Yeah.
Why not?
There's
maybe
no
he
agenda.
Doesn't. Maybe he doesn't need feel he needs to write his name or write things. Maybe he doesn't really want to do that. Or maybe he just feels he's not as good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can be, you know, you're in reason to say I'm not really good at doing a certain thing and saying, but I'll play to my strengths.
Yeah.
And,
which is the best bit in being creative, because you fold into that thing and you make the badass scene out of it.
You use a weakness as a strength, whatever, you know, you can do whatever. But that was the stuff to me that was groundbreaking. We were doing it with Carpe, and end of the day, the scene was on its ass, nothing was going on, the acid house thing had taken over, and just a few of us wanted to paint, and we just wanted to disassociate from the American thing, I think mainly because... I think it got a bit tedious as well, because you talk to people trying to, you know, you always come across people who are outside of the culture, and they're always like, well, we're not really interested in what you guys do, because you're just copying America, innit? You know, and that was the thing about
that
it.
That was the thing, yeah.
It was kind of like, oh, it had to be seen as, it's just cool and trendy. It's a big thing in New York, and everyone here is copying it now. And it just got a bit like, hang on a minute, you know. And in the end, it was a bit like, well, we've got nothing to prove in that arena anymore. Let's try something different.
Yeah.
Then it feels fresh.
Yeah. And you're challenging your successes, and you're doing something a little bit different, and it works.
We went on with that into the 90s, and I'm thinking in terms of graphing, only really came back into age from mid to late 90s when that bloody Jason Nevins Run DMC thing came out, and there was a revival, and everyone wanted New York bubble letters again and stuff.
Isn't that crazy?
And it's kind of like, you know, hang on.
Cultural appropriation
We've been beyond that for years. Now you're going to send us back there.
Yeah.
And now you're all looking at us like, we don't fit in.
Yeah.
Because that was it. In the graph world, it was like, oh, you guys are just art fags. And in the art world, we were like, it's just graph.
Yeah, yeah.
And spray paint. Yeah. It's not accepted in our world. So you were kind of like on the threshold of neither here nor there, really. And in some ways, I'm kind of like, okay, that's fine then. Mm. So be it. It's bullshit anyway. Mm-hmm. At least we're doing what we want to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And not trying to do what everyone says we should do or fit into some particular market or someone else's ideology. Mm. It's just like, end of the day, if it's really about being a renegade, then be a renegade then, and be yourself.
Stamp
be your
yourself.
Own person, exactly.
It takes, like, again and again, it takes a lot of strength that, like, you...
It's, like I said, it's lonely. It's a lonely place to be.
Yeah. Do you feel like... This isn't an observation. This is a purely personal question.
You're going to go into observational comedy.
No. What's it called when you do like miming? I'll do this miming as well. do you feel like as time's gone on, that nonconformity can be to one's detriment, not in a technological, but in a solitude kind of way? Do you feel like sometimes your story gets sidelined because other people bark louder?
So you can really feel like you're flogging a dead horse sometimes.
Yeah.
And or you do stuff and it goes over people. I've done so many things where it's just gone over people's heads.
Yeah.
And then I see people doing it now and I'm like, oh, hang on. All right, you're painting colour signal test strips and CMYK things. And when I did that, everyone thought I was just nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he painting them all around East London? Just painting whole walls white and just sticking a little CMYK square matrix thing on. And
you kind of get removed from the history books.
People will use it as fill-ins, as styles. I've seen the signal. I did a signal test, I think, just off Shoreditch High Street.
Yeah.
And I've seen a building somewhere in the Middle East.
Mm.
Enormous side of a tower block with that on, and I'm like, 10 years later, all kinds of people using it. But, you know, when I've done it, it's kind of like, don't really understand that. Well, it doesn't say anything, and it's not an image.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? And it was all a conceptual approach to things,
It's crazy.
I was deliberately trying to be a conceptual. Another project I did was just, I went around Shoreditch deliberately because it was all saturated, and I was painting whole walls white. And I had someone laser cut a stencil for me of all their HTML code. And I just put a code in the middle in the blue and red. And it actually took you to a link that just gave you the driest, flattest description of the wall surface. but it was all about the whole thing of painting all these walls over and over. So it's so thick with paint that it's all flaking off.
And
you're only doing it day after day, just for a photo to upload. So it's like, okay, why don't you just paint the code on there then?
That's amazing. Then you
put the code in your phone and go straight to the internet. But it's a conceptual approach, and to me, that's then you, to me that feels like an authentic way to be subversive, or if you really want to be vandalism or whatever, that is the way to do it, because it's got to kind of be like, eh? What the hell's that code? What is it?
So sick.
Put it in your phone, we'll put that in the phone, see where you're going. Then you get to it, and all you get is a really flat, dry description of the wall, like almost like Exhibit A. Metal framework wall covered in acrylic paint.
That's amazing.
It doesn't describe any artwork on it, but it, in some ways it's just like, this is where we've gone, really. We've actually left our physical being behind and disappeared into this screen. I mean, that's it. Now the world is officially shrunk because it's on my screen. I can Skype my friend in Australia now. There's no distance. It's gone. It's abolished.
We don't even say hello anymore.
No more distance, no obstacles, no more plane fare. It's just here. And what we got to talk about? Probably not much. Yeah. Just like, what are you up to? We end up talking about, well, yeah, washing machine's gone again. You probably end up talking the most banal.
But I mean, having said that though, we haven't seen each other. When was the first time we saw each other? Last time we saw each other?
Last time I might have been New York. I'm sure I saw you walking around Ladbroke Grove one year. And I was a bit like, is it? Isn't it? Is it? And
we're talking easy like 20 years.
Yeah, something like
that. Come on, I mean, but maybe even more. Bro.
I first met you, I think, on the tour when you were touring with Vadim and Mr. Thing. Yeah. And I was with New Flesh. That had been 1999, I think.
You come around the house and it was like next day.
That's it.
Do you know what I mean? That one chat on the phone, yeah, come through. And it's like, cup tea, chilling.
That's
just
it.
Just like we would have done.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, it's lovely tea as well, mate.
Yeah, I see you. We only have some plans in the Killer Keller podcast and the Mighty Part 2. Thank you so
mighty.
Much.
Mighty? What's this?
Telling you, bro. Legendary.
You're too kind.
It's a fucking pleasure.
It's a pleasure, man. Hey, we're going to have to sanitise hands now, you know what I mean?
I ain't joking.
Stays on the surface for
We got this. Yeah, we got this. Hey, 2020 business. Only doing it like this.
That's it. Keith K. Hopewell, a.k.a. Part 2ism, a.k.a. Part 2, with the man Killer Keller here just to say, fuck you, coronavirus.
Fuck you, coronavirus. Big up all area group. Thank you so much for passing through, brother.
Yeah, it's absolute a pleasure, man. Always a pleasure, man. I'll come round again for a tea.
That's
worth it for the tea.
Mikasa Sukasa, I say it to everyone that comes through, you know what I mean? If you're in the area, you know what you do.
That's it. Now I'm going to go and puff on this now.
Yeah, it's a lovely little chug. another cup of tea in the pot. Live and direct, Central London, every week, all right? Killer Keller Podcast, thank you for tuning in. Stay lucky and stay out of touch of dodgy viruses and strange women, all right?
Cheerio.
Take care, people. Peace.